You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the August 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of The Coast of Utopia by Karina Chocano. The path to White's Beach at Broken Head is lush and shaded by a canopy of trees. It opens on a wide, white, secluded, sandy beach. The Adamos came here today with the Winchesters and some friends, visiting from Finland. Adamo is surfing. Winchester is cradling newborn Daisy. Clementine is riding Wilkie around like a pony. Winchester moved here from Sydney 8 years ago because she wanted her kids to have an old-fashioned lifestyle, she says. That's why I send them to Steiner School and all that. No test, no tech. Trying to slow them down in such a fast-paced world. Sometimes she regrets not separating her personal Instagram from her business account, she says. Adamo looks at her in amazement. But people connect to the brand through you. Later that afternoon, I meet Mia and Hannah and their little boys in Brunswick Heads at Ethel Food Store, a cafe on a busy thoroughfare. They order flatbreads, and their kids order kombucha. The sisters live in Mullumbimby, of which one tourist website says, "If you're wondering where all the hippies in Byron have gone, take a drive to Mullumbimby." Hannah and Mia are happy to get out of their parents' house, where they are living while they Airbnb their own homes over the break. For the summer, they took 3 months off and went on a road trip. They rented out their houses to get rid of some debt and stuff and spent 3 months camping outdoors. I was pregnant the whole time, so by the end I was so tired, Mia says. I think I fell pregnant 2 weeks into the whole thing, Hannah says. It was good fun. It's hard work, says Mia. 12 weeks straight. No hot showers, Hannah adds. Yeah, I think the longest we went without having a hot shower, like a proper hot shower, was like 6 weeks, Mia laughs. The kids were filthy. They had bucket baths. Being away reminds them of why they love it here. Instagram helps make living here possible. I don't know how companies ever got off the ground before, Mia says. It was so much harder. That's our outreach, Hannah says. They didn't start Instagramming until they had a product, Mia says, whereas brands with more marketing savvy, she realizes now, build a following before launching a product. They already have an audience, Hannah says, and they go, oh, we're doing this as well. Whereas we waited until we had everything, and then we were like, here's our Instagram. They laugh. I think it's nice for people to see that you are moms. You have all this shit going on, but you're still able to run a business and live your life a certain way, Mia says. I don't really know what I was posting before. Whereas now, I feel like you almost have to have like a brand identity. She pauses. The less time you can spend on it, the better, really. There's a lot of talk about the Instagram community, but less talk about the effect of Instagram on actual communities. Byron is small and insular, and the brute force of social amplification has a way of distorting things. In normal life, you'd be out with girlfriends, and hundreds of thousands of people aren't going to see you eating spaghetti, Alexander Johnson says, but in Byron Bay, that is a possibility. Her husband grew up here and finds it quite hilarious to see his town turned into a social media hub. You're an influencer, and you hang out with your friends who've got 500 followers. Suddenly, overnight, they've got 5,000 followers. 10,000 followers. Then you've all accidentally become Instagram famous by virtue of each other. It kind of self-perpetuates. It's an awkward spot to be in, this influencer business, and it affects friendships. I know I live in this absurd white privileged bubble, Alexander Johnston says. I know that. But I also do genuinely have a heart for women and change and community, and I care about my children. There's more of an understanding of the value of privacy now. Not everyone is thrilled to have their picnics uploaded every time. She thinks a backlash is underway, which she has been privately enjoying. This only started happening the last 6 months, and I found it amazing, she says. People are having their birthday parties or baby showers, and they say, this is a no Instagram event, and you're not allowed to take photos, take videos, upload, post to stories. People don't want to be the cause of other people feeling left out of a birthday or a dinner. Or if someone's smoking a cigarette, they're a mom and they have a cheeky cigarette once every 6 months, and they're caught in the background of someone's Instagram video, and they get absolutely slammed. Or they just don't want their baby shower plastered over 15 different Instagrams. They just don't want that anymore. And this is becoming much more of a thing in this area, actually, and I find it quite nice. It's quite refreshing. On the flip side, she has noticed that when you log off Instagram, your invites can really take a hit. A lot of stuff in this town is like, let's do something at the farm. So-and-so is there giving out free somethings. All your girlfriends are going. The thing is, there isn't anywhere else to go. There are like three places. It's just a small town on the east coast of Australia. You've been here. There's not a lot going on. Back in Los Angeles, I called Imogen Edwards. Recently, Edwards split from her partner. They sold the house in France and returned to Byron. It was really just a bit of a fantasy game where you're like, wow, could we do this? She says of the move to France. I didn't think it through too much. Kind of more, let's have life experiences. We can do this. How lucky are we to be able to do this? I remark that it's funny how she left one fantasy life to live another similar fantasy life. You don't understand the level of people messaging me, basically shouting at me, going, what the hell are you doing? Like French chicks going, like, I follow you all because I want your life. On her return, Edwards says she was very honest with her raw feelings about the experience of moving to not just another country, but the idea of another country. And that's the reality, she says. Everything looks beautiful, but something was missing for me. It occurred to her that everyone is striving for this perfect life, posting perfect pictures, feeling the pressure to say that everything's perfect. And I'm like, I don't want to have to say it's perfect. I don't want people to feel like I'm living a perfect life, because I'm far from it, you know? No one knows the internal battles and the ups and downs. I'm just sick of putting that out. Mum Instagramming, she says, can lead to real connections and alleviate the isolation of being a new mother. It can make you feel like someone's got your back, she says, like, oh, I'm not alone. But it enables a false intimacy, too, and a lack of accountability. You can delete someone. You can disappear. The community is a shared illusion that's real until it's not. Speaking of France, I ask if she's heard that children there will now be allowed to sue their parents for posting pictures of them on social media as children. One day, I guess the kids are going to be like, Mom, why did you post that picture of me? I look ugly. You'll get this backlash from your kids. You don't know until they're grown up, and they turn around at you and they're like, bloody hell, Mom, I can't believe you did that. Whereas another kid might go to their mom and say, thanks for doing that, Mom. I'm a supermodel now. I never had to work for a place because you made this platform for me. Thank you. Bitter Pill by Bethany McLean. Opioids have claimed more than 400,000 lives since 1996. David Sackler, in his first interview about America's deadliest drug epidemic, insists his family is not to blame. Opening photograph by Peter Hapak. David and Joss Sackler in New York City. "We didn't cause the crisis," he says. On a brilliantly blue spring day, David Sackler, a third-generation member of the now infamous Sackler family, sits in a large conference room high above Manhattan. He's a big, bearded guy in his late 30s, and he's dressed casually, in slacks and a blue V-neck sweater that matches the sky. But the tension in the room is palpable. Sackler's family, which founded and owns Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin, is widely viewed as the central villain in the opioid crisis that is devastating America. David has decided to come here today over what he calls the consternation of advisors and family members to break his silence about the Sacklers' role in the drug epidemic. Since OxyContin came on the market in 1996, more than 400,000 Americans have died from opioid overdoses, including some 200,000 from prescription opioids. Millions more continue to struggle with addiction, and entire communities have been devastated by the epidemic. 48 states, along with more than 500 cities, counties, and tribal governments, have sued Purdue, accusing the company of fueling the crisis with a wide range of deceptive practices. A lawsuit filed by Massachusetts, the first to name the Sacklers, paints a picture of an almost impossibly venal family who continued to push sales of longer-lasting, higher-dose prescriptions of OxyContin long after it was clear that both increased the risk for addiction. Since 2008, the Sacklers have made $4 billion from Purdue, most of it in the form of profits from opioids. 8 people in a single family, the Massachusetts suit alleges, made the choices that caused much of the opioid epidemic. The backlash against the Sacklers has been furious. In recent months, many leading institutions that once happily accepted the family's generous donations have announced they will no longer touch what the website Inside Philanthropy calls blood money. The Metropolitan Museum of Art, whose Sackler wing houses the famed Temple of Dendur, said in May that it will reject any gifts from the family. Only days before my meeting with David Sackler, protesters at the Guggenheim took to the museum's grand spiral walkway to drop white slips of paper meant to mimic OxyContin prescriptions and to unfurl a banner with the message, "Shame on Sackler." Even Purdue's banker, J.P. Morgan Chase, an institution that has been fined billions of dollars for working with everyone from Bernie Madoff to Syria, has declined to do business with the company. Gossip had it that David and his wife Joss, a fashion designer, rock climber, and linguist, were being excommunicated from New York society. When a reporter covering her clothing line dared to mention the scandal surrounding her family, she retorted, "Stop talking about who the men in my life are and review the effing neon hoodies." In a story headlined "Sacklers Fleeing New York City Following Family's OxyContin Scandal," the New York Post reported that the couple was selling their $6.5 million apartment on the Upper East Side and moving to Palm Beach. Yet even as the rage around the Sacklers has escalated, No one in the various branches of the family that are still involved in Purdue has spoken to the press. The three Sackler brothers, who founded the company in 1952, including David's grandfather, Raymond, have all passed away. But David, who runs a family investment office and served on Purdue's board of directors from 2012 to August 2018, thinks it is time for at least one Sackler to share his version of events with the public. I'm poking my head over the parapet, he tells me. When I ask him why he wants to talk, he cites what he calls the vitriolic hyperbole and endless castigation of his family. I have three young kids, he says. My four-year-old came home from nursery school and asked, why are my friends telling me that our family's work is killing people? Sackler also laments the way our philanthropy has been turned against us. The family, he says, has been giving where our hearts are for 40 years. I hope we can have a conversation with our philanthropic partners, he adds. I hope they have a change of heart. As he reviews his family company's history of developing and marketing opioids, Sackler mostly talks in the dispassionate tone of the financier that he is. But the emotion is obvious on his face, and it sometimes breaks through into his words. At times, he appears almost on the brink of tears. At other times, he struggles to control his obvious anger. In his view, his family is being blamed for something they did not do. Purdue, he insists, did its best to be responsible in the face of changing science about the benefits and risk of opioids. I understand the argument that Purdue was among the first to talk about the supposed benefits of opioids, he says. We were. But as the science changed, we put safeguards in place. About the many lawsuits, he says, I really don't think there's much in the complaints, frankly, that's at issue that's not just, oh, you shouldn't have marketed these things at all, right? And I guess that's a hindsight debate one can have. The real problem, he thinks, is primarily one of narrative. Because the family has never spoken, others have seized control of the story. We have not done a good job of talking about this, he says. That's what I regret the most. By going public, he hopes we can begin humanizing ourselves as a family. He also thinks about what he will tell his children years from now when they inevitably ask him about this period. I feel the need to answer that I told our story. I told the truth. I did the best I could for better or for worse. Next photo, death spiral. Following protest, the Guggenheim and other museums have announced they will reject any gifts from the Sacklers. This photo shows the interior of the Guggenheim, which is built with a spiral effect, and it shows people lining the various floors with banners, take down their name, showing the number of dead each day and saying shame on Sackler. It appears that every one of the people are dressed in black and the banners are black letters on a red background, very striking against the white of the interior of that Guggenheim building spiral. It is not until later in the conversation that he brings up the countless lives that have been devastated by the drug Purdue sells. We have so much empathy, he says of his family. I'm sorry we didn't start with that. We feel absolutely terrible. Facts will show we didn't cause the crisis, but we want to help. But even in the most trustworthy of environments, facts can be slippery, prone to manipulation and misinterpretation. And in the pharmaceutical industry, where money can buy science, sway patients and providers, and influence the regulatory environment, facts are just one more thing that's for sale. During the 1980s and 1990s, when David and his two sisters, Rebecca and Mariana, were growing up in Greenwich, Connecticut, one of Purdue's products was a drug called MS-Contin, a morphine-based opioid that was widely used to treat late-stage cancer. One proposed benefit over competing products was that it was controlled release, meaning that the medication was released into the bloodstream over time, rather than all at once. While reports vary on MS-Contin's track record, Sackler says there wasn't much abuse, which left Purdue unprepared for what happened when it won approval for OxyContin in 1995. He also points out that attitudes toward pain medication were beginning to change even before the launch of the new drug. To argue that OxyContin started this, he says, is not in keeping with history. It's certainly true that the medical approach to pain was already in flux at the time. By the late 1980s, the idea that non-cancer pain itself had to be treated had begun to take off, said Dr. Ranga Krishnan, CEO of Rush University's medical system in Chicago. I think it was with mostly good intentions. Between 1991 and 1997, the number of opioid prescriptions increased from 76 million to 97 million. But Purdue went all out to sell OxyContin, which consisted of a pure concentration of oxycodone, to doctors and consumers. In its first 6 years on the market, according to the General Accounting Office, Purdue spent up to 12 times more promoting OxyContin than it had MS-Contin. It was like a perfect storm, says Robert Martyr, MD, a longtime consultant to medical staffs. They were pushing this just as this patient-centered culture around pain came into vogue and providers were more hesitant to deny people prescriptions. David's father, Richard, had a high-level role in marketing at Purdue during the intensive push. In 1999, he became president of the company and later served as co-chairman of the board. He clearly believed in the power of opioids to treat pain, but whether the belief drove the profit motive or the other way around is hard to say. "You won't believe how committed I am to make OxyContin a huge success," Richard wrote in a 1999 email that was obtained earlier this year by Stat and ProPublica. "It is almost that I dedicated my life to it." In the 5 years after OxyContin came on the market, the annual number of prescriptions soared from 670,000 to more than 6 million. Sales of the drug, meanwhile, rocketed to more than $1 billion. $1 billion. David Sackler is willing to concede the two major scientific assumptions that fueled the drug's success were wrong, though he contends that both were supported by the science at the time. The first was the marketing claim, endorsed by the Food and Drug Administration, that OxyContin was less prone to abuse because of its extended-release formula. In fact, the timed-release tablets turned out to be more prone to abuse, in part because they packed more opioids into each pill. The inconvenient truth, as the FDA noted in 2010, was that the risk for misuse and abuse is greater for extended-release opioids. The second claim, that less than 1% of patients taking OxyContin would become addicted, was based not on a peer-reviewed study, but on a five-sentence letter to the New England Journal of Medicine, published in January 1980. The doctor who wrote the letter has since expressed regret that drug companies misrepresented it in their marketing campaigns, pushing opioids as non-addictive. The letter has become a central piece of the narrative of Sackler venality. How could anyone with any sense of morality use such flimsy evidence to sell a dangerous drug? David, however, insists that there was far more scientific consensus around the 1% figure than just a single letter. His representatives point me to studies showing that no less than four different entities, including the Institute of Medicine at the National Academy of Sciences, considered the risk for addiction to be very minimal. Sackler also cites the second edition of a standard clinical reference on pain medication, Bonica's The Management of Pain, which was published 6 years before OxyContin was launched. Narcotic addiction, the textbook states flatly, occurs rarely, or not at all, in patients receiving narcotics for medical use. By citing such sources, Sackler is making an argument that he returns to again and again, that Purdue was not alone in believing that opioids like OxyContin were safe and effective enough to justify the risk. There is certainly an element of truth in that argument. To single out the Sacklers as the source of all evil is to ignore the role of many others in both industry and government. But the evidence that Sackler cites does not appear to be supported by any truly substantive science. Some of the material, in fact, is sourced to the original letter from the New England Journal of Medicine. A recent study found that the letter has been cited more than 600 times by other scholars, a widespread pattern of inaccurate citation that contributed to the North American opioid crisis. Even today, Sackler continues to insist that the addiction rate for OxyContin is vanishingly low. He cites a review last year in the British Journal of Anesthesia, which he says puts the rate at 4.7%. What's more, he continues, even that number may be overstating the risk. That includes both abuse and dependence, he says. Abuse is addiction. Dependence has a very different definition. When you look at the studies that pull out the addiction piece of it, I think a fair number is somewhere between 2 and 3%. Purdue's critics scoff at such assertions. Andrew Kolodny, MD, co-founder of Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing, says the British article was only a review of other studies, none of which was explicitly designed to measure addiction in patients taking opioids for months and years at a time. The very shift in treatment that Purdue pushed to bring about. Just about anyone who takes opioids for long enough and at high enough doses can get addicted, says Kolodny, who has long been one of Purdue's chief antagonists. But the debate over the precise level of addiction rates obscures a broader truth. OxyContin is a so-called Schedule II drug, which means that it is known to have a high potential for abuse. Sackler points out that this fact was noted in the drug's insert, and he argues that striking the balance between the beneficial effects OxyContin could have and the possibility that patients would get addicted was not Purdue's job, but the FDA's. You say, okay, first of all, it was known that those patients were going to exist. and the FDA approved this medication with that balance in mind. So like any medication that has unintended side effects, you knew that this was one. It was approved as one. Doctors understood it, right? The FDA, for its part, acknowledges that it contributed to the epidemic. The opioid crisis is one of the largest and most complex public health tragedies that our nation has ever faced, says a spokesperson for the agency. Sadly, the scope of the epidemic reflects many past mistakes and many parties who missed opportunities to stem the crisis, including the FDA. But even if Sackler's larger point is valid, that the FDA and doctors bear responsibility as well, it hardly absolves Purdue. Aggressively marketing the drug as not addictive, and then saying, "We warned you it's addictive," is a very dark version of trying to have your cake and eat it too. And if you understand that some percentage of patients are going to get addicted, then by definition you understand that the more pills you sell, the more addiction there's going to be. And there were a lot more pills. Instead of trying to limit the supply, Purdue pushed hard to expand it. From 1996 to 2000, according to the General Accounting Office, the company more than doubled its internal sales force, recruited and trained more than 5,000 doctors, pharmacists, and nurses to help tout the benefits of OxyContin, handed out free 30-day prescriptions to new patients, and targeted its marketing efforts to doctors who were the highest prescribers of opioids. By 2008, the United States, which represents less than 5% of the world's population, was consuming more than 80% of the world's opioids. One of the key issues in the growing campaign against Purdue and the Sacklers is if or when the company and its board should have understood what OxyContin was unleashing and what they should have done in response. As early as 2000, when the U.S. attorney in Maine issued an alert warning about the risk posed by OxyContin and other opioids, there was clear evidence that something was badly wrong. But the company did not halt its push to sell higher doses and longer-term prescriptions of OxyContin, both of which increase the risk for addiction, and both of which were highly profitable for Purdue. As the company's staff told the board in 2014, two of the greatest risks to the company's bottom line were continued pressure against higher doses of opioids and continued pressure against long-term use of opioids. In September 2017, according to the Massachusetts complaint, Purdue's CEO jotted down a note summarizing some of the roots of the opioid crisis. It reads, "There are too many prescriptions being written, too high a dose, for too long, for conditions that often don't require them, by doctors who lack the requisite training in how to use them appropriately." Sackler insists that the company did all it could in response to the crisis. "You can be as cynical as you want and say we should have moved faster," he says, "but there was imperfect information in an incredibly complex market. Building a plan was not that simple." In 2001, Purdue voluntarily suspended the highest dose of OxyContin and formulated a program called 100 Counties, which drew on demographic information to pinpoint trouble spots. Sackler also says Purdue began keeping a list of doctors suspected of running so-called pill mills and barred salespeople from calling on them. None of the facts support the notion of these craven people just blithely ignoring the risk, he says. The company was trying to do the right thing under incredible stress. One thing the company did was place much of the responsibility for the crisis not on the drug itself, but on its users. Virtually all of these reports of addiction, a company executive told a congressional committee in 2001, involve people who are abusing the medication, not patients with legitimate medical needs. That was a sentiment shared by Richard Sackler. We have to hammer on the abusers in every way possible, he wrote in a 2001 email. They are the culprits and the problem. They are reckless criminals. Although David acknowledges the insensitivity, he is nevertheless protective of his father, who he says was expressing a legitimate worry that criminals were being confused with patients, and whose sentiments, while out of keeping with today's views of addiction, he sees as not so out of line with the consensus at the time. I've gotten a lot more information about addiction in general and opiate, or opioid addiction in particular, and of course my views have evolved and changed, Richard said in a deposition last March. At that time, I was very concerned that the balance that had been struck by the FDA between the benefits and the risk of strong opioids might be upset, perhaps with terrible consequence for patients and for doctors who wanted to treat them. David also says that his father, who stepped down as co-chairman of the board in 2007, is someone who struggles to communicate. He just cannot understand how his words are going to land on somebody, Sackler says. He recounts an incident from a childhood hockey match where he was a goalie. It was not a good game, he recalls, and I came off the ice, and I was really down. And his words to me were, that wasn't a good one, was it? And he just sees me kind of crumble in front of him. Such bluntness, Sackler adds, comes across even harsher in writing. For a person like that, he says, email is about the worst medium possible to communicate in because there is no other cue. And so he's saying things that sound incredibly strident and sound incredibly unsympathetic. And that's not the person that he is. In 2007, the government announced that Purdue would pay $600 million, one of the largest fines in pharmaceutical history, to resolve criminal and civil charges brought by federal prosecutors, who accused Purdue of having illegally marketed and promoted OxyContin as less addictive, less subject to abuse and diversion, and less likely to cause withdrawal symptoms than other pain medications. Three Purdue executives also pled guilty to a misdemeanor charge of misbranding and agreed to pay $34.5 million in penalties. Simply put, U.S. Attorney John Brownlee declared in announcing the settlement, the genesis of OxyContin was not the result of good science or laboratory experiments. OxyContin was the child of marketeers and bottom-line financial decision-making. Sackler seems to view the settlement as both monumental and minor at the same time. Any time your family business pays one of the largest fines in pharmaceutical history, it feels like a big deal, he says. But the language he uses has the subtle effect of making Purdue's misconduct sound like the result of a few bad apples on the sales team. It is conduct that the company engaged in, yes, he says. A number of sales reps took the language on the label and overdid the safety. We wish it never happened. For sure, the company should have had a more robust compliance framework and should have weeded out the reps that were misbranding the medication. For sure. The settlement required the company to enter into 5-year monitoring agreements with federal authorities and 26 states to ensure that in the future, Purdue will market and promote its products in an honest and responsible manner. In addition, the company agreed to formalize what it was already doing to track doctors suspected of running pill mills by keeping a state-by-state list known informally as Region Zero. Salespeople were prohibited from calling doctors on the list and were not compensated if they did so. But according to the lawsuit filed by Massachusetts, Purdue continued to target doctors who ended up losing their medical licenses for dangerous prescribing. Sackler acknowledges that the company didn't always get it right in terms of which doctors it placed on the list. Is it perfect? He asked. Of course not. Far from it. The company made the best decisions it can with incredibly high stakes. It is life-ruining to accuse someone of diversion who isn't doing it. He also says that until 2016, when New York required another opioid manufacturer to institute a do-not-call list, Purdue was alone in trying to identify doctors who ran pill mills. Every person we shut down was one more than the rest of the industry did, Sackler says. We're doing this voluntarily, and we're the only ones. Making what is essentially a legal point, he says the board was frequently briefed that the abuse and diversion program was in compliance. Sackler also points to the company's decision in 2010 to launch a new form of OxyContin, one that was supposed to be an abuse deterrent because it couldn't be broken down and snorted or injected. We made a tremendously honest and ethical effort to fix a problem, he says. That's all. To fix a problem. The reformulated OxyContin, he adds, cost more than $1 billion to develop. At the time, he points out, the new version was praised by many of the state attorneys general who are now suing the company for marketing it. We have gone past the point where no good deed goes unpunished, he says, into the theater of the absurd. But it is hard to see the move as merely a good deed. The abuse deterrent form of OxyContin was approved a few years before the patent on the old version was about to expire. Then, and what an investigation by Esquire magazine called a breathtaking pivot, Purdue fought to prevent would-be generic competitors from copying its old version of OxyContin. The company, Esquire observed, argued that the drug it had been selling for 15 years was so prone to abuse that generic manufacturers should not be allowed to copy it. Sackler argues that the timing was a coincidence. The abuse deterrent form, he says, took years to develop. In our conversation, he repeatedly decries the company's critics as cynics. But given the all-out marketing push behind the original version of the drug, some of the cynicism would appear to be earned. It was 2 years after the launch of the abuse deterrent form of OxyContin that Sackler joined the company's board of directors. He says that his father, who had suffered several strokes, was in failing health. I think my dad's vision was that I would replace him at some point as his health continued to decline, Sackler says. By 2014, the company had also brought in 5 outsiders to serve alongside the 9 family members who sat on the board of directors. David wasn't a pharmaceutical industry insider, and although he worked for a couple of summers at Purdue, he went straight into finance after graduating from Princeton. He worked for two prominent New York money managers, Perry Capital and OSS Capital Management, before starting his own hedge fund, and then a family investment firm. Sackler speaks of investing as an almost noble calling, one that hinges on honesty and accountability. It's this quest for truth, he says. For my personality, it just fits very well to try and sort through all of that, and then to be very introspective about what you got right and what you got wrong. He adds, I've never enjoyed those relationships or interactions with people who can dispose of their failures without any hesitation. In retrospect, it seems inconceivable that the Sacklers didn't see that their family's reputation, and perhaps their fortune, was going to be demolished by the opioid crisis. But David says the maelstrom took him by surprise. I don't think any of us had a sense of what a problem this was going to become. You've just had the federal government complete a monitoring program. You've settled with the states. To think that this liability question would pop up now, or that I would be personally sued, was so fanciful, nobody could have envisioned this in 2012. Underneath the legal arguments about what the Sacklers and Purdue may have done wrong lies a deeper, uglier truth. America's system for approving, regulating, and marketing new drugs, for determining, in effect, what the facts are, is often influenced by corporate money. While Sackler defends his family actions as being in line with the FDA or with the consensus opinion from pain experts, the reality is that the consensus opinion is purchased so often and in such insidious ways that trust is impossible. Sidney Wolfe, M.D., a leading consumer advocate, points out that the FDA's approval process for new drugs is funded mostly by fees from drug manufacturers. It is the culture of the FDA, from the leadership down, to make things easier for industry, says Wolfe, who served on the FDA's Drug Safety and Risk Management Committee from 2008 to 2012. It is beyond question that the FDA is also culpable in creating and fueling the opioid crisis. An FDA spokesperson calls allegations of industry influence absurd and factually inaccurate. Then there are the patient advocacy groups and researchers who take money from drug companies. According to a Senate report last year, Purdue and four other opioid manufacturers have paid 14 advocacy groups and their affiliated physicians at least $9 million since 2012. By aligning medical culture with industry goals in this way, the investigation concluded, many of the groups described in this report may have played a significant role in creating the necessary conditions for the U.S. opioids epidemic. Between 2000 and 2002, according to exhibits recently released in the lawsuit filed by Oklahoma, Purdue also provided more than $1 million in funding to a powerful but little-known entity called the Joint Commission for the Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations. This was a pivotal moment. In 2001, the commission issued a sweeping new set of standards that emphasized the treatment of pain. The importance of the standards cannot be underestimated, says Brian Seitz, M.D., director of acute pain service at Dartmouth University School of Medicine. Those standards are how hospitals survive, and when pain assessment became equivalent to measuring blood pressure, it drove over-prescribing and over-treatment. In 2016, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention finally stepped in to curb the epidemic of pain medication, issuing new guidelines that discourage twice-a-day prescriptions of Purdue's three most profitable doses of OxyContin. We know of no other medication, the CDC observed, that's routinely used for a non-fatal condition that kills patients so frequently. Sackler says Purdue promptly sent copies of the guidelines, which he calls controversial, to providers. But the CDC's move sparked an extraordinary backlash. A panel of medical experts appointed by the Department of Health and Human Services issued a draft report essentially countermanding the CDC guidelines, insisting that the dosage and duration of opioid prescriptions should be left to doctors. The National Association of Attorneys General, in turn, wrote an open letter calling it incomprehensible that HHS would weaken medical guidelines issued by the CDC. Sackler sees it as shocking that state prosecutors would question the system itself. The science is always changing, he says, but today it's very rapidly changing, and it's so much driven by headlines and people who are not medical experts that it's difficult to watch, where state attorneys general will actually write an open letter to Health and Human Services complaining about their recommendations for how to use a pharmaceutical product. This is another world, right? It's astonishing that these people feel that their voices should overwhelm medical evidence that HHS is looking at. It's really crazy. But it actually isn't crazy at all. When so much of the system that is supposed to protect the public has been shown to be for sale to the highest bidder, who can people trust? If the current system is under attack as deeply corrupted, the drug industry has only itself to blame. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.